Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Members of the National Rifle Association converged in Houston over the weekend to attend the NRA's annual convention. Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre called on members to remain vigilant in the fight to protect gun rights. But not everyone was of the same mind. Across the street, a group of protesters mobilized by Mayor Michael Bloomberg's group, Mayors Against Illegal Guns, read the names of 4,000 victims of gun violence. This comes just weeks after a series of measures failed in the U.S. Senate related to gun control. Some of the proposals would have expanded background checks for certain gun sales and banned military-style assault rifles and high-capacity magazines. The legislation may have failed, but the debate over gun control isn't expected to go away anytime soon. Today on Intersection, we'll explore both sides of the debate and see if any middle ground can be reached. Joining me in studio to explore the topic, Dale Roberts is the executive director of the Columbia Police Officers Association. He's an attorney who specializes in firearms law, and he's also taught firearms law and safety courses in the past few years. Thanks for being here, Dale.
Certainly. And I didn't realize that was going to be in the introduction. I'm not here on behalf of the CPOA.
Okay.
I do work for them, but that's...
Sure.
They have plausible deniability.
Sure. Thanks for naming that right at the front. And then David Rossman is a commentator for the Columbia Missourian. His writings could also be found on his website, inkandvoice.com.
Thank you.
And then for you and our audience, do you own a gun? What led to your decision to purchase one? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you can join our online chat. Okay, so first off, we wanted to just kind of start at the beginning, I guess. So this proposed legislation that failed at the federal level had a lot of different proposals in it. One of them that was probably mentioned the most were these gun show loopholes or other loopholes for background checks and that sort of thing. Maybe if you guys could help us explain that a little bit on what these controls are, what we're talking about when we talk about loopholes.
Well, I lived in Colorado in 1999 during the Columbine shootings, and I was working with the individuals from – the parents from those shootings to close the gun show loophole, or one of them anyway, in Colorado. And that was selling guns to one person so that another can use it and own it. That other person may have a felony, may not, for other reasons, may not be allowed to own the weapon. But that was the first of the loopholes that were there. The other problem is that in a lot of cases, not necessarily here in Missouri, but in a lot of cases at gun shows, individuals can sell weapons. And as an individual, not a licensed dealer, you don't have to check background. The problem, and one of the very good arguments, is how do you do that if I'm selling a firearm out of my home? Do I have to do a background check on the individual now? And that's a very hard question to answer, but I think it's part of the argument and a very legitimate part.
And Dale, that differs substantially from what dealers have to go through, I guess, when they're
– Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I'll say as to David's first point, that what he described is what's known in the industry as a straw man purchase, where you're disqualified, so I go in and buy a gun for you. It's a felony – I mean, it's a federal felony offense, but it happens. And then from the – as you said, dealers, federal firearms licensees, FFLs, are strictly regulated, have to follow requirements. I gave you a copy of a form referred to as a 4473. Anyone who comes in to purchase a firearm fills out that form, and the dealer calls NICS, National Instant Check System, which is run by the FBI, to do the background check.
So why is this something that's being proposed at the federal level, and how would it change some of these other sales you're talking about?
Well, as David said, in Missouri, for example, an individual is not regulated. So if I have a gun that I don't want anymore, whatever the case may be, I can sell it. And there's sort of two elements to it. One, I'm not required to, as a non-licensee, I'm not required to do a background check. But two, I'm not allowed to do one. The NICS system that a dealer uses to call in and check on the purchaser, if a private individual attempts to use the NICS system, that's a federal offense. So that would be that would have to be changed in order to facilitate private background checks.
And so obviously this didn't pass at the federal level. What is the rationale behind someone who would oppose closing these loopholes or, I guess, having these background checks more expanded, I guess, to some of these other venues?
Well, I think it's a little bit more than that. And that particular – the federal law, it also had to do with restricting what type of weapons can be sold, and it had to do with universal background checks, and that's what we're talking about right now. Can the background checks actually be universal? And that's, again, a very, very difficult question to answer. It's a very difficult question for logistics for the feds and for local law enforcement. So that was part of the problem. The other part of the problem with that was on a political side is the conservative majority, the right-wing conservative majority that is pushing the GOP majority in the House to pass or not pass bills concerning Second Amendment rights. And even though constituents of their own home states are vast majority, anywhere from 70% to 90% in favor of such universal background checks.
So what are the restrictions, though, on a person-to-person sale?
And first of all, I want to say we have not – people in the firearms industry have not seen statistics that support what David just said. I'm not saying they aren't there, but we just haven't seen things to support the 90% who want the checks. Having said that, I agree with universal background check in concept. What worries me is the application. And one of the things that was in the bill that was proposed, I've got a copy of it here, the term transfer. You have to do a background check if you're going to transfer a firearm. And what is a transfer? Under previous law in Missouri, there were those that argued if I want to loan David my shotgun so he can go duck hunting this weekend, that's a transfer, and we'd have to do a permit. And there were other people who said, oh, don't be silly. Transfer is a sale. Under the federal bill that was proposed, if someone helps you move, or if I'm in the hospital in a coma and somebody goes and moves my stuff, that's a transfer and a felony offense. If someone borrows a gun and goes beyond certain limits, that's a transfer and is an offense. So, as I said, I and some of my friends may not agree. I agree with the concept of universal background check, but how it's applied, I think, needed to be refined somewhat. And I'm sorry, you asked me another question.
The other question
I didn't answer the question.
No, you're
you
fine.
Asked.
You jumped on to the next point. But, yeah, back. I was kind of taking a step back to say, so what are the restrictions on those person-to-person sales since the at a gun show, for the example we've been going through, where you may not have to go through this?
The dealer, whether he's at a gun show or no matter where he is, a dealer must do the 4473, which is a background check. Individual does not have to do it. Missouri law says an individual cannot knowingly sell a gun to someone who is prohibited. So a while back, I had a friend who said, I want to buy a gun for you. It's for my cousin. He's got a felony. Well, no, I'm not going to sell it to you. Absolutely not. I don't want any part of that. If you knowingly or have reason to know someone's disqualified and you sell it to them, that's an offense.
But there may be some gray area there, I guess, right? Because you may not – it's not requiring you to do a lot of research necessarily.
No,
it's just using best judgment based on what you know.
You're not – as I said, an individual is not required to do a background check. And, in fact, as far as the NICS program goes, not allowed to do one. So the statute says you can't knowingly sell to someone. And that would be dishonorable discharge, felony conviction, under indictment – conviction for domestic abuse, adjudicated mentally incompetent or other mental problems, sort of the usual.
And those are the people that are supposed to get pinged by that national database.
Absolutely.
Right. I do want to take 1 minute to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuller, and today we're talking about the contentious issue of gun control in America. Following the failure of multiple measures in the U.S. Senate that would have made significant changes to federal law, where's the debate headed, and what middle ground is there? Today we're exploring that issue and talking about what it means here here in Missouri, too. Joining me in studio are Dale Roberts. He is an attorney who specializes in firearms law, and David Rossman is a commentator for the Columbia Missourian. For you and our audience, do you think there should be more limits on gun ownership, either locally or on a national level? We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We like to remind you that that Intersection is presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 online at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. Okay, we have a question from the chat room, actually, that I just wanted to throw in very quickly. So it's from Shane Rogers. He was asking about, I think, at the federal level, if it is the GOP, why did the Democratic Senate shoot down some of this reform, including Senator Reid?
Part of that is wanting to get reelected. And that's a real strong point. And even the couple of senators and House members that are not going up for reelection, they also backed because they want to maintain for at least a portion of their population, this level of acceptance. And I think that's very important. When you have states like Montana, Nevada, Colorado, where I lived for 25 years, Wyoming, here in Missouri, you have an awfully large contingency of individuals who will be gun owner advocates and believe that the Second Amendment is an absolute. So that is the reason I believe, and I haven't been able to talk to these people. I had a phone call into Senator Feinstein, Dianne Feinstein from California, this morning. Unfortunately, I had to leave before she got back. But that was one of the questions that I was going to pose to her also.
Mm-hmm. And it varied because each of these measures got voted on individually, and so there were Democrats and Republicans that voted each way on a number of them. But yeah, there were many that voted party, but there were a few that broke from party as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
And one of the issues you ask about, you use the term pinged, where, you know, what causes denial, the mental health records has seemed to be a really big problem in terms of states are not submitting mental health records to the NICS program as they're required to do. Now, in the state's defense, they've said, well, it's an unfunded mandate. We don't have the money to do it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Colorado, and I was looking for the numbers because I have them for some other states, Colorado is really low in terms of not submitting mental health records. And unfortunately, they endured, you know, the shooting at Aurora. And so there are people in some quarters that are saying, well, those people maybe should have been mentally disqualified. Yeah. You should be turning those records in.
And there was anecdotally the shooter in the Virginia Tech shootings was actually declared mentally ill by a judge and was still able to purchase a gun. He wasn't pinged by the system.
Absolutely. And if I can take just a second, because I ran some of the numbers, that, and these are on a web page I can give to you. As far as mental health records submitted, North Dakota has submitted one. South Dakota 2, Nebraska 3, Montana 3, Wyoming 4. And I don't know if people in those states are just really mentally healthy or if those states just aren't turning things in. California has submitted 510,800 names and Pennsylvania 650,000 names. So there's a broad difference between what states are doing in terms of turning in. And I think the NRA agrees. I think any reasonable person would agree. People who are mentally disqualified, those numbers should be repeated or reported. And I can tell you, as I'm judge advocate with the American Legion Post here, there's a special provision for soldiers returning from combat who more and more really may need some counseling. And in the past, they've been afraid, if I go, I'll lose my guns. And that's sort of part of my life as a soldier. And a bill was passed a couple of years ago that's the Firearms Restitution Act, I think, that says, go get the counseling you need. And federal law now says, once your doctor says you're okay, we'll restore your rights.
But I want to catch up on one thing also, is that even those in the GOP are splitting ranks. On April 18th, Bill O'Reilly suggested a national gun registry on his show. Again, I gave your offices the web connection. You can find it on YouTube. The discussion afterwards is a little confusing, but Bill, it sounded, was very, very serious about this. Mm-hmm. Well, wouldn't a national gun registry cause the same problems as universal background checks? One of the big fears, I believe, coming from the gun ownership, the NRA, and the other organizations, is this absolute unfounded fear of having their guns taken away. I wrote in my Thursday column this week that the only way I can see them do it is the president calling back the entire armed forces from overseas, getting a hold of all the National Guard, every police and safety officer in the U.S., putting them in front of every door, and at 4 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, raid everybody. I don't think it's going to happen. And quite frankly, the amendment will not allow that to happen.
We do have a call. Paul from Columbia. Paul, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling in.
I was listening to the program, and you had all these, to me, seemingly false objections to gun registration based on criteria that we easily solve through registering vehicles. A vehicle is very dangerous if it's driven by somebody in an unsafe manner. So is a gun. Registering a gun, registering a vehicle aren't so different. In fact, Department of Motor Vehicles would be a good place to go for coordinating this.
All right. So, Dale?
Well, the first response to that has usually been ownership of a vehicle is not guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States. Ownership of a firearm is.
That has nothing to do with it. We're not talking about taking away guns. We're talking about registering an item that is dangerous.
So how about this? How does it differ from, in addition to that basic guarantee, what is the difference between between that process, I guess? What are the objections to that national database for gun ownership?
Well, for starters, criminals don't obey the law. So, criminals drive without insurance all the time. Criminals drive – you hear cases frequently of somebody who's had 4 or 5 DWIs, suspended license, and they're still driving. And the vast majority of the crimes that are committed with guns are committed with people who were already criminals. And, the fact that it's illegal to take a gun into a bank doesn't seem to stop them. The law-abiding people – will usually abide with the law, and the criminals will continue to break the law. So I'm not sure how registration by law-abiding people will stop the criminal effect.
And I agree with that. There's even with universal background checks or national gun registry, you're not going to stop the use of firearms in committing of a crime or, unfortunately, something like we saw in Aurora or in Newtown. What I think, though, and one of the big arguments that I have, and I've written about it a couple of times, is how could you look at somebody and say that's a criminal or that person is mentally ill, especially if it's a private one-on-one sale? That is exceptionally difficult, and it's the basic problem with talking about criminals and the mentally ill. It's also the problem with straw man purchases because you may not know the weapon is being purchased for somebody else.
And I think the Bureau of Justice or the FBI, one of the two statistics, I could dig it out, indicates that about 39% of firearms used in crime were acquired from a family member. So, and I've worked in stores where we caught people trying to do that, sent them out of the store, called law enforcement, turned them in. But it happens. And as I said, the statistics suggest that about 40%, 39% of the crimes, the gun came from a family member, which means, the registration, the background check, that sort of stuff may not prevent it. What I certainly support is, zealous prosecution of firearms crimes. And that doesn't seem to be happening at the moment.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to thank Paul for your call. Paul, if you're still there, thanks a lot for calling in.
This is Paul Wallace again. I think you guys are missing the point. If a car is carjacked and the policeman stops somebody for traffic violation and they see that this car is stolen, then that's a felony and there's a punishment. Same thing would be true for a gun that's registered. So I think you're inventing excuses to prevent legitimate registration and legitimate regulation of guns.
And at the moment, there is no database, right? There's no real database
that's
like he's
right.
talking about.
That's correct.
And so I guess that's probably something that many people are wanting to are opposed to, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And that's what Bill O'Reilly was talking about implementing on his show. Mm-hmm. So if this becomes an exceptionally contentious issue, and I used to be a gun owner. When I moved here, I sold my weapons to other individuals. But I understand the problem from both sides. It's not that I am anti-gun. I have never been that way. But how do you know? It's easy to figure out if somebody's driving a car. It's not that easy to know if somebody's carrying a handgun. Mm-hmm. So that's the problem. And you can't just say, oh, this person is registered.
Lost Paul. Thanks, Paul, for your call.
I'm looking over here for Paul. That's one of the big problems with a national registry also. We don't know unless you are doing something almost like what they're doing in New York City, which is they stop and search. Mm-hmm. If there's any reason that a police officer has, and correct me if I'm wrong on that one, but on a reasonable search, they can, you know, look in the car, look in the house, look in if they believe that there is a firearm illegally owned.
And Dale, maybe just to answer the question directly, why are people afraid of a creation of a database like that on a federal level?
Well, I don't know which order to go, but for one thing, and David said earlier, you know, it would be unlikely, if not impossible, for gun seizure to take place in America. But it's happened in England. It's happened in Australia. And those are fairly civilized nations. And their crime rate has risen with guns. You now have to be a registered butcher to buy a meat cleaver in England because that's become one of the weapons of choice. So for one thing, I'm not convinced it could happen. I'm not worried about the black helicopters necessarily, but it's happened in civilized countries, and I'm not, you know.
But in England, I have friends who are reporters and editors in England. In England, that was pretty well supported by the general population. Here, we don't get that support. Here, you have an absolute line drawn in the sand that says you can, you can't. That the Second Amendment is an absolute, and then the Second Amendment is not necessarily an absolute. And we already know that fully automatic weapons are not permitted. I cannot go out and buy a bazooka.
Well, you can if you can pass the background.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and that's a common misconception. And
Maybe that's a good point to get to, though, because the name assault weapons gets thrown around a lot, mm-hmm. especially, and that was one of the things that was included in this U.S. Senate bill that was shot down. So maybe Dale, you could help us on this. What are they talking about when people say assault weapons, and what kind of machines are we really talking about here?
And that's one of the problems.
Absolutely.
It was a term that was invented and depends on the legislation. The Crime Control Act, I think it was, of 1994, said that an assault weapon is something which has some of these elements. And it said, you know, a flash suppressor or a hand grip that extends downward, a collapsible stock, holds a bayonet, because we've had a lot of drive-by bayonettings. There are these different components. And the funny thing was, it didn't have to have all those things. If it had 4 out of 6, then it was an assault weapon, which means, you know, it's not necessarily bad to have a flash suppressor as long as the flash suppressor isn't on the same gun with a collapsible stock. And I'm not sure how any two of those things were okay, but not more than two were okay. So, you know, the assault weapon definition is really a challenge. To most of us, it's any ugly black rifle. Mm-hmm. is considered an assault weapon.
And plus, when they're categorizing an assault weapon, they're using a term that would normally be used for a fully automatic weapon. The weapons that are sold over the counter at any of the gun shops here, rifles, for example, and correct me if I'm wrong because this is an old information that I have, but I believe you're allowed to shoot 3 rounds continuous and it's not a fully automatic.
No.
Okay.
Single,
that's
one
wrong.
Round at a time. Okay. I mean, as fast as you can pull the trigger, but it's one pull, one shot.
Yeah. Okay. So, if I'm fast enough, it may sound like I have a full automatic weapon, but quite frankly, that's part of the problem. These are assault type weapons, and I think the term needs to be very specific when we're talking about these. An AR-15, the lookalike of the military M16, for example, is an assault type weapon. It's not really there for hunting. It is not there, well, for the most part, for home protection. It is there for one reason. It is a military-style weapon. Not to say that it's incorrect to own those. You know, and I don't want the audience to get the idea that I'm an anti-gun guy, because I'm not. But it is a terminology that really needs to change in our legal lexicon. And for the journalists like myself, in my lexicon also, I try not to use assault weapon or assault type weapon. It just doesn't work.
And so Dale, though, what David mentioned there that he viewed what these weapons are for. I guess what would your thoughts be on that? On who owns these weapons and why you would own what we would call an assault weapon here for this point of discussion? I guess.
Well, you know, the foundation thought is. The Second Amendment – well, excuse me. It's the Second Amendment is contained in the Bill of Rights, not in the Bill of Needs. You know, the Constitution says I have a right to have it. I don't have to have a need to have it. It's probably not the most popular weapon to be used. But, I mean, there are people that hunt with an AR type rifle. They're actually much – the interesting thing is people are afraid of them, but they're much, as a rule, lower power rifle than hunting rifle. You know, a .308 or a .30-06 hunting rifle is a more powerful round than the little .223 that's fired out of most AR-type rifles. So I think David's absolutely right. The definition has been pretty fluid, and, you know, Massachusetts has their definition, and under their definition, I believe the firearm that Adam Lanza's mother owned was lawful. Mm-hmm. Because whatever their definition was, it fit. So it's a challenge to say what is an, you know, what's a dangerous car? Well, depends on who's behind the wheel.
So people will actually use them for hunting, though?
Or is
Yeah. It's not because it seems like I know I've talked to some hunters, and usually it's not really like from their perspective, it seems like that's not part of the sport, right? Or if you're able to shoot off multiple shots at the same time,
but you can shoot off just as many shots with an old. The old .30-06 that belonged to my dad that had what we call walnut furniture, you know, walnut stock, walnut grips. You could shoot that as fast and as many shots as you could shoot with the ugly black rifle. So, in functionality, the difference is cosmetic, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
And the other problem is, and the big argument is how large is the magazine? Whether it is a 10-shot magazine or a 30-shot magazine.
And that was part of the legislation, too, that didn't pass. Yeah.
And in Aurora, the thinking, because I have friends of mine who are still deputy sheriffs in Colorado, the general thinking was if the rifle being used there was limited to 10 shots instead of 30, we might not have had the same carnage.
And again,
that's a big question whether or not that would happen.
Who knows? Yeah. I mean, you know, if you know how to shoot your firearm, you can usually do a magazine change in 1.5 seconds. You know, I've done training, the law enforcement police instructor class, where we did what are called tactical reloads, and they're pretty fast. And the other thing, I mean, I'm not saying you can't judge an entire problem by one incident, but if you look at the shooting in Columbine, Eric Klebold, I think his name was, had 10, you know, the legislation is saying we need to go back to 10-round magazine ban, which is what we had under the gun control ban in 1994. You couldn't have a magazine that held more than 10 rounds. Well, in the shooting at Columbine, that's what they used. Eric had 13 10-round magazines, and Dylan had, you know, 8 or 10. I mean, they were shooting low-capacity magazines, if you will.
We're going to have to take a quick break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journal Institute. Today we're talking about the contentious issue of gun control in America. We'll be right back here after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection. This is a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the contentious issue of gun control in America. Following the failure of multiple measures in the U.S. Senate that would have made significant changes to federal law, where is the debate headed and what middle ground is there? Today we're exploring that issue and talking about what it means here in Missouri. Joining me in studio are Dale Roberts, the Executive Director of the Columbia Police Officers Association, although he's not here representing that organization today. He's an attorney who specializes in firearms law, and David Ross is a commentator for the Columbia, Missourian. For you and our audience, do you think gun control is effective at reducing violent crime? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia or join our online chat. Okay, so we can maybe just pick up where we left off. We were talking about those magazines that might shoot. I think it was 11 was the number that they were talking about at the federal level. Take maybe a little bit more about that debate and what, I guess, Dale, what the opposition is, I guess, to limiting those magazine sizes.
Well, the studies showed that they don't do any good. I mean, there's a lot of research that came out of the FBI, the Bureau of Justice Statistics. That's not the right name, but I find it. As far as the vast majority of crimes are not committed with high-capacity magazines. I mean, there are some notable. The one in Newtown is certainly noteworthy. But as I was saying, you know, the one in Columbine, they weren't using high-cap mags. They were using small what would be considered normal or small mags. There are a tremendous number of crimes still that are committed with revolvers. And so, you know, while it might restrict some scenario, and as I said, you know, if you know how to use a gun, you can change a magazine in about a second and a half. So it may have some benefit. I don't think much, but what really concerns me is it doesn't address other problems that would be much more beneficial.
Like what?
Well, the mental health, you know, the mm-hmm. mental health problem is I think a huge problem. We touched on it a few minutes ago that there's so many states who are not reporting mental health records, and they say, well, we can't afford it. And I know times are hard, the budget in Missouri is tight, but to me, that's a priority. I mean, I think I would cut something else out of the budget before I would fail to report mental health declarations to a national firearms background check.
And do you think there's more, too, that we can do beyond that thing that's already supposed to be enforced?
David, about mental health first.
Well, yeah, and I want to back that up because and from a personal standpoint, I do take drugs for depression. But I wouldn't be on that database because my doc is saying, you know, here's the drugs. Go. You feel better. Good.
He hasn't reported you somewhere or something
like
that.
And the problem becomes is that most of the drugs for mental health are prescribed by MDs, not by psychiatrists. So that is that becomes a secondary issue. Who is going to be responsible? At what level of mental health are we going to say, no, you can't own a firearm anymore? If a person is in an institution and the courts have said this person has his mental illness or her mental illness is just too far gone, no weapon, or if the doc makes that declaration to the courts, I think that's fine. But there's all of this stuff that we're talking about is all slippery slope stuff. We don't know where the ends are. We don't know when or if we can fall off a cliff. And I think that becomes an exceptionally important point in the discussion, a point, by the way, that both sides, the extremes on both sides, seem to forget, that there's this vast middle ground that's really not being explored.
And I think the NRA, and I don't agree with everything they say, but I think the NRA came out and said we need to do more on mental health checks. And while there, you know, no matter what you do, there's going to be somebody who falls through the cracks somehow. But at least the states aren't even reporting people who have been adjudicated suffering from mental disease or defect. And so at least get those in the database, and then you know, you may get to the people who got a prescription and should they be disqualified? That's a different question. You know, that's the next question. But at least report the ones who have gone through the process And, you know, as we said, I think was his name Cho, who shot at Virginia Tech, mm-hmm. had been adjudicated mentally having mental problems and was not in the database.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess there's also, I mean, if you want to talk about loopholes there, since there is no federal database of who has guns, if you were to buy a gun maybe before you were even reported by your doctor or something like that, right? It's tough for that to be tracked, I guess, right? I mean, there are definitely some holes there, like, as you're referencing. There are definitely some holes when it comes down to where keeping track of people with mental illnesses and defining who should not be allowed to have a gun.
That I'm not sure about, because the ATF can track a firearm down. They don't have a registration per se, mm-hmm. but if they know you purchased a firearm, they can go looking for it. And there's a mechanism, you know, if you have a concealed carry permit and and you disqualify for some reason, they can follow up on it. So I'm not absolutely sure about tracking those. But you're right. You know, it might not provide an opportunity to backtrack and take mm-hmm. a gun back from somebody who's subsequently been disqualified. And it's certainly not going to solve the, you know, what I said earlier, the study showed about, it was almost an even split. 39% of criminals use firearms that are stolen, and 39% more or less of criminals use firearms that they got from a family member. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a family member that provided one of the recent shootings, may have been the Boston brothers. I don't know.
No, it was the my brain.
Well,
just
Lanza.
Lanza's mom. And these weapons were there. The bigger problem that I see is not necessarily the criminal intent, but there have been so many stories in the last month or so from the beginning of April of children getting a hold of their parents' firearms or having their own firearms. This one 5-year-old who had his 22 caliber rifle that was made for young boys and girls, because they make them in pink, but it was in a corner, and that weapon shouldn't have even been available for that child to touch, period. I don't think one of the laws that needs to be changed is holding the parents responsible. For a child, anybody under whatever age we're going to put on at 16, 18 years old, whatever it's going to be, the parent is responsible making sure the weapons are safely stored. And if a child can get a hold of it, that's a problem. If you have a child like we've had in the past, I mean, I can think of a number of them off the top of my head, but where mom on the Lance shooting, where mom bought the guns legitimately, she is a well-qualified shooter, but they were out and they were available, easily available. And I think that's part of the problem. So
what could change that equation for the, I guess, from the mom? Because that's really where it's coming down to, I guess, in that situation.
Well, in that particular situation, but I did a quick research this morning before I came in here. April 10th, 4-year-old shoots a 6-year-old with a 22 caliber rifle. New Jersey boy, 6, dies after a 4-year-old shoots him. Mm-hmm. April 29, Virginia Times dispatch. Mother of 2 involved in a non-fatal shooting incident has been arrested. Mm-hmm. And so we have a number of these. I have a whole list of them. Well, but I think we really need to look at the adults. The adults are supposed to be the responsible individual. Mm-hmm. And if they're not responsible, and something does happen, let's put the blame where the blame is. And that is to the child first, but it may be the parent. Mm-hmm. A 5-year-old has no clue.
Right. Well, and you've written a column also about training, and maybe that's a preventative measure there too, is training. So maybe talk a little about your thoughts on that.
Well, and again, this goes to the people who buy weapons legally. But still, I think there should be a mandatory training, how to use the firearm. I made a number of phone calls last week and this week to dealers around the Columbia area. Target Master told me that they are 80% of their new gun owners are taking firearm safety lessons. But if you purchase a gun, let's say, at one of the pawn shops here, they don't care. They're going to do their background check. They're going to fill out all the paperwork. They'll take your money. They'll hand you a weapon. And I think that is a problem. And that can, that one, I think, can be more readily resolved with the NRA, making the NRA responsible for making sure everybody's getting proper training. Because if the NRA is responsible for that, they can't complain about it.
I want to jump in real quick and just – we have fact checkers just in case, and they're checking my facts here. When I mentioned earlier about maybe being able to confiscate a gun after the fact that you've lost the right to own one, Bloomberg News reports that California is the only state that actually tracks and disarms people that are legally registered guns who have then lost their right. So that's for me. But I guess to that same point, Dale, you've actually done some training. You've been a trainer, I guess. Maybe from your perspective, how important is that, and what are people learning during these training sessions?
Training is critical. You can't make people learn. You may be able to make them go to a class. You can't make people learn, although that's not a reason not to train. But training is critically important. There are people here in town who do extraordinarily fine training that exceeds what the state requires. David was talking a minute ago about the youth, you know, the problem with small children being killed with firearms. And I, you know, sound cynical and say, well, parents aren't responsible for anything else. You know, why are they responsible for this? But, and it sounds terrible, but it's kind of true. But I will say this. One of the instructors I work with, a guy named Todd Burke, and we taught a concealed carry class for the legislature, and a topic came up, and we did some research, gave some language to Senator Dan Brown. He introduced Senate Bill 75. And it's progressing and may actually pass. And there are two components to it. One of them is that first-grade children in schools throughout Missouri should be taught either the Eddie Eagle program or the equivalent of it if you don't want to use that program.
And which Eddie Eagle is?
Eddie Eagle is a program that teaches you if you see a gun, stop, don't touch, leave the area, tell an adult. And, you know, like 7 decades ago, we started teaching children if there's a fire, stop, drop, and roll. And I think there's been one child fatality in a school fire in the last 7 decades. Seems to work. And similarly, you know, we think children should be taught, if you see a gun, stop. Don't touch it. Leave the area. Go tell an adult. And that passed the Senate, although there were no votes from the legislators from St. Louis. I'm not sure why. But I think that's a key, and that's a video, and this may be why some people oppose it. It's a video that's put together by the NRA, okay. But if you watch it, there are absolutely no credits. There's no way of knowing who did it. And the bill says, well, if you don't want to use it, use your own as long as it doesn't promote or discourage, takes no philosophical position on firearms. And the NRA said, we'll provide free copies of that DVD to every school in Missouri because we believe in teaching kids, stop, don't touch, leave the area, tell an adult.
And so for training, though, for, I guess, adult training, who is required or who is getting trained, I guess, right now in the state?
The only statutory requirement is if you get a concealed carry permit.
Or if you're a hunter. Hunters have have to take a hunter safety. The problem with that is they only have to take it once. There is no renewal of that hunter safety training. So after 2 or 3 years, that individual might have gotten into habits that are unsafe. And I think that's very important and one of the laws that really needs to be changed in this state and in others. I mean, the conversation I had with the Department of Natural Resources here really stressed the idea that really no state is requiring hunter training past the first time. There are some sidebar stories that go along with that you don't have to be trained if you're going to see what hunting's like for a season and you're hunting with a licensed hunter. But it's and you can get a license without the training. But this is one of the problems that we do have. It's that on the training that's currently required, it's a one-time deal. And I think I personally and I'm not an anti-gun or an anti-NRA guy, but I personally believe that needs to be changed. And once that's changed, we may see other changes in requirements of training, including the training of use of a handgun.
Dale, do you have any reaction to that?
Oh, I mean, it won't address, you know, the greater topic about gun – well, won't directly address the greater topic of gun crime and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. David, maybe I'm not – you know, I don't disagree with him. If you start to work on awareness – of firearm safety, hopefully it spreads. And, you know, I'm sorry I forgot about that when I said there's no other training required. I'm not a hunter. That's kind of outside my – it's not on my radar screen.
I do want to take a minute to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the contentious issue of gun control in America. Following the failure of multiple measures in the U.S. Senate that would have made significant changes to federal law, where's the debate headed and what middle ground is there? Today we're exploring that issue and talking about what it means here in Missouri. Joining me in studio are Dale Roberts. He is an attorney who specializes in firearms law, and David Rossman is a commentator for the Columbia, Missouri. And for you and our audience, how do you think authorities could prevent the mentally ill from obtaining a gun? We'd love to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And I guess back to that thought of the mentally ill. I know we kind of moved on from that, but I guess I wanted to go back and just ask what either of you think the federal government could be doing better, I guess, or how could they enforce, like you said, some of the states aren't reporting. How could they enforce that? How could that change realistically?
I suspect the states want money. I mean, I think they're saying it's an unfunded mandate. And as I said earlier, well, if it is, you know, I don't know about the legal technicality on unfunded mandates. That's not something I follow. But whether it is or it isn't, I think it's an important issue, and I would fund it before I spent money on some other things. I don't know if David.
Yeah, and I agree with that. But I also believe that a lot of the legislators, both federal and state, are really afraid of the lobbying efforts of the NRA. And the NRA will push to make sure that background checks and gun safety programs and their own agenda. And if you don't walk in their steps, they're going to fight you and you may lose an election. And I think that's the biggest problem with our politicians today. They're so afraid of not winning an election that they're afraid to take the stance that they would have taken if it weren't for that threat.
And I will say, you know, certainly the NRA is a group to contend with. But from what I've read, they support, I think, fully support the mental health component of doing the checks, you know, getting mental health records into the federal system. Certainly there are other things they don't like, but that's one that I think they go along with. They and Joe Biden actually agree.
Yes. Well, but one of the things I want to pick up on that is that there is another slippery slope that comes up, and that is the HIPAA laws. Hmm. Once you start to go into the area of saying, well, we have to report if this person is not mentally stable enough to own or to use a firearm, whether it's court adjudicated or some other methodology, what is to stop the rest of your medical history to go out?
Right, which HIPAA laws are the ones that protect your privacy from medical records.
So that is an argument I have been seeing a lot of from the some pro-gun owners, but really advocates of training, advocates of limitations. And I think one of the other problems is that the pro-gun owner groups, these people who don't want any restrictions because that's what they believe the Second Amendment says, what they are also saying is that everyone should be permitted to own a weapon. And that was a NRA argument from a number of years back. Mm-hmm. When they were arguing whether or not the mentally ill should own firearms.
And that's – and ultimately that's what we're talking about, right, is the Second Amendment. Dale, you've referenced it a couple of times. But I guess how would you respond to what did you say?
Well, I'm not familiar with the NRA's position that everyone should be allowed to hold possess a firearm. And as I said, I don't agree with the NRA on a number of things. And the U.S. Supreme Court, when they decided the Heller case, which is sort of the – Second Amendment case in 2008, said, you know, the absolute right to keep and bear arms still excludes people who have mental disease or defect, still excludes, you know, maybe convicted felons. You know, they went through a few things and said, you know, the First Amendment has, you know, free speech, but there's some things you still can't do. And similarly, that applies in the Second Amendment. And so that, as a gun owner, doesn't offend me. I think it's interesting sometimes that, you know, a felony bad check could disqualify you from having a firearm, and some misdemeanor assault cases wouldn't. And you know, I'm not sure how you work that out, because violent crimes to me are different than, you know, what I guess you might call white collar crimes.
Right. But I mean, it says shall not restrict. But like, as you're saying, there are restrictions in place for what many people on every side would agree are pretty logical reasons. So, yeah, where I guess is there some theoretical line? Is there some magic line that you think where someone that is you know, the NRA, for instance, might say, okay, now we're going too far? You know what I mean? Is that part of what this whole debate's about, I guess?
Well, the one that I think the NRA certainly says you're going too far is registration. And, you know, there's a part of me that, you know, we talked about some components earlier that, well, we don't think that would ever happen. And the problem, especially here in Missouri, the problem is, well, it was against the law for the state to release concealed carry records, and they did it. And then they tried repeatedly to hide it. And so when you tell me, oh, that'll never happen, all I have to do is look in the Missourian or listen to KBIA about recent, you know, occasions where things that were never supposed to be released were released. Makes people nervous.
Yeah, or in the case, again, here in Missouri, not just the departments in Missouri, the Department of Motor Vehicles, but the State House attempted to get into that database.
Or somebody on a computer in the State
right.
House. Yeah.
And even though they were doing it with the purpose of figuring out if they can do it, they didn't tell anybody, and that's still an illegal act. So I think one of the problems that we do have is we're making this so politicalized and where it's no longer human. And I think the human factor is much more important. And I agree with Dale. Somebody who's convicted with a felony check writing, that person probably will never handle a firearm to do anything. And fortunately or unfortunately, I know a lot of felons from my days in Colorado. But one of the things that I really, really do see, though, is that the idea of teaching people how to use their weapons safely, teaching people that when you do have a gun at home, please lock it up, because most of the guns, illegal guns, have been stolen from homes.
And police officers.
Kansas
yeah. City this spring, there was a fair number of guns that were stolen from Kansas City police officers out of their cars. And, you know, you think if there's somebody and we all make mistakes, but, you know, stolen firearms are a significant portion of the firearms that are used in committing crimes. I know the trainers I work with really push the home safety component. And the nice thing, you know, people say, well, what if somebody breaks in and I need it in a hurry? There are safes that, you know, little gun safes you can put by your bed that use a finger touch and spring open. It takes a few seconds to get them open. There are other ways to safely, you know, store a firearm and still have it accessible if it's needed. That doesn't offend me.
Yeah, there are trigger locks that work the same way. That you don't have to have something that will take you 2 minutes to undo, or you have to go searching for a key. I think one of the big problems, again, is that we are looking at this from a political viewpoint. We're not looking at it from a human viewpoint and the safety of our citizens. And we're talking about – and one of the political things is we're talking about all these rules are against the law-abiding citizen. What does a law-abiding citizen actually look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking about the political thing. In Missouri, it's very obvious it's political. Dale, you referenced earlier the thing that was mainly geared toward protecting – or you're training children.
Yes.
Still has trouble in the legislature. Basically, anything that has to do with guns specifically in Missouri – has some issues. We just had a bill passed out of the House recently that made it a federal offense to try to enforce new federal gun laws, right? Mm-hmm. So from your take, what's the situation in Columbia, and can real change actually happen on the state level, or is it going to have to come down from the federal level?
Well, the changes happening on the state level are primarily protection and expansion of Second Amendment rights. On the federal level, as Dave and I have said, there are a number of issues where, and I'm not saying it has to have the NRA stamp of approval, but I know that's an issue. There are a number of changes that the NRA agrees with. You know, the mental health one keeps coming up. Training school children in Missouri, stop, don't touch, leave the area, tell an adult if you see a firearm. And I've always been the kind of person that said, well, let's do all the things we agree on. Let's get that done. Then we can start, we can go back to arguing about things we disagree on if there are any left. But, you know, if there are things we agree on, let's do it.
Yeah, and that's a proper negotiation tools is, you know,
let's get the easy stuff out of the way first. We'll take care of the hard stuff later. But I think also, even if we were to go for the easy stuff, even if we were to say those individuals who the courts have said are mentally ill to a point where they should not and cannot own a firearm, I think we'll still get the political arguments from the other side. And that's just part of the American system, is to have that argument and be contrary. Because if we weren't contrary, we would still be with England.
And I don't know about who the other side is, because I do think conservative – I mean, there are people on both – you know, the recent defeat of the Farms Bill in Congress wouldn't have passed but for support from Democrats. So there are people in both parties who, you know, have varying opinions. But I hope I'm not naive. I mean, I think the majority of legislators support the mental health component. And so far, it would appear the majority of legislators in Missouri support the, you know, Senate Bill 75, which actually had two parts. One was train children, if you, you know, stop, don't touch, you know, leave guns alone and tell somebody about it if you see one. And then the second part was that school faculty should be trained on how to respond for active shooter intruder training, that you don't just roll up under your desk and wait for your turn to be shot. And that's not necessarily saying, you know, hand out guns to everybody in school, but it's certainly, and this is something a friend of mine's doing now, there is very meaningful training that can be provided to schools on how to actively respond to an intruder and or shooter. And I don't know that anybody would disagree with that. Mm-hmm.
We have just a couple minutes left, so I just kind of wanted to wrap up and talk. I mean, you mentioned doing the easy things, and that sounds like the U.S. Senate, there was a New York Times article saying that the U.S. Senate, that's kind of what's in the works right now, is looking at trying to close some of those loopholes, which it seems like a lot of people agree on. And then there's also a gun trafficking bill that a couple different legislators are trying to look at. But I guess, what do you think might actually happen, or do you think the answer is nothing? I guess, what do you think?
You know, to try to guess what the legislatures are going to do is near impossible. I stopped doing that years and years ago. I don't know what will happen. I think there are a lot of good ideas out there. And I think there are ideas, as Dale has said, that the NRA and the pro-gun people and the anti-gun people are going to agree with. I think they have – I think the two sides have just forgotten, or three or four sides, depending on how you're talking about it, have just forgotten how to talk to each other. And I think that dialogue is the first thing that has to happen. It doesn't matter what our legislators may do. It matters, are they talking? And right now on the federal level and on the state levels, it's just not happening. And I think that's part of the problem with the gun issues, is that the two sides, the from a political standpoint, just don't want to talk to each other.
Dale, you've got a little bit of time left.
Yes, and one quick example. Under President Bush, I think the first President Bush, 41, started what was called Safe Neighborhood Operation, where they did zealously enforce and prosecute gun violations, trafficking, things of that sort. And it was effective. The statistics were very positive. So I think if, you know, reasonable enforcement of gun violations would go a long way to control some of these problems.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guest, Dale Roberts, an attorney who specializes in firearms law, and David Rossman, who's a commentator for the Columbia Missourian. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, Ruben Stern, Vanita Rizvik, and Katie Moritz. Travis McMillan's our technical director with production assistance from Eric Stazak. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Femuehlner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.